ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Hi, this is Mike Behe, Senior Fellow with Discovery Institute. In 1996, I kicked over the hornet's nest with my book, Darwin's Black Box, and Discovery Institute has been there for me ever since. They've been there for a lot of us, and you make that possible by your financial support for Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery Institute needs your help now more than ever. Please consider giving a donation today to support the Scholars of Intelligent Design. To give, go to discovery.org/CSC2021. That's discovery.org/CSC2021. Thanks very much.
On today's ID the Future, we're pleased to bring you Rice University synthetic organic chemist and inventor James M. Tour, speaking with Dr. Brian Miller. Miller is the research coordinator for Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture and an expert on thermodynamics as they relate to the origin of life.
Let me introduce our guest for today. It's Dr. Brian Miller, and he is of the research, he's research coordinator for the Center for Science and Culture for the Discovery Institute in Seattle, Washington. He holds a BS in physics with a minor in engineering from MIT and a PhD in complex systems physics from Duke University. He has extensive expertise in the application of thermodynamics and information theory to the problem of the origin of life. His other interests include how the effects of mutations on the stability of protein folds relate to the rarity of functional proteins and their application of engineering concepts in biological systems. He is also a technical consultant for thestartup.com, a virtual incubator dedicated to bringing innovation to the marketplace. And with that, I introduce our guest, Brian, and Dr. Brian Miller. The first question I want to ask you is this. With all of your education, how is it that you can believe in something so amazing as the physical resurrection of Jesus Christ?
Well, it'd be helpful if I shared a little of my background. When I went to MIT, I became pretty convinced God didn't exist. I read Richard Dawkins' book, The Blind Watchmaker. I was told the Bible is just a bunch of fairy tales. And I realized that if God didn't exist, then life was pretty much pointless, that I'm just going to die and cease to exist. It doesn't matter if I'm happy or sad or kind or cruel. And I remember just in my room, I said, God, I don't know if you exist, but if you do exist, you have to prove it to me because I'm a scientist. I didn't know if that was fair, but that's just the way it was. And that sort of put me on a course where I could really see God's providential hand in my life, where I was able to meet leaders in the field of faith and science, people that were experts in the resurrection. And it was really a two-part journey. One is I came to realize that science points to a creator at every level, from the design of our universe to the design of our planet to the design of ourselves to the design of ourselves. I also came to realize that the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus is overwhelming, both from the history, from eyewitnesses, different things like that. But also, it was encountering God very personally, seeing miracles, experiencing the love of God. So it was both an intellectual journey and a personal journey that I came back to faith and realized. And I think this is really what made the difference for me, because a lot of people want to seek after truth as a hobby. But I told God if he was real and he proved it to me, I would dedicate my life to serving him, that I would give him everything. And he honored that request. And since that point that he's shown me that he exists, that Jesus Christ is the Lord of creation, that he died for my sins on the cross, I've dedicated myself to speaking the truth about the evidence for God and Jesus Christ and about sharing his supernatural power to transform lives.
That's great. That is great. What an explanation. So it's interesting that you went through this phase where you didn't even believe anymore after reading some of these books. And then it became obvious to you through science. You know, that's a lot of it. You know, I came to know Jesus Christ when I was a freshman in college, and I loved him so much. I loved Jesus so much. It was never a question after that. And the science only underscored all of this, the beauty of the creation, just the beauty of it. And let me start with a first question here. It's a little bit long, but I want to set the stage for you, because you are in from what I know, just an excellent thermodynamicist. And so, Dr. Miller, you're an expert when it comes to explaining thermodynamics, entropy, and energy, and how it relates to living systems. The simple meaning of the second law of thermodynamics says that systems move from lower to higher states of entropy. And so it follows that the spontaneous formation of a living system by chance is unlikely. As Hoyle put it, it's like the chance of a tornado going through a junkyard and assembling a Boeing 747. But some systems do move from high to low entropy state. For example, ice has a lower energy state than water. Can you explain to the average listener the difference between what happens with ice and the requirement for life, and how all that relates to prebiology, life's building blocks, and the requirement for life in the first place, where abiogenesis is before biology takes over? This is the origin of life. How did that first living system form?
Entropy is simply a measure of the number of ways that a system can exist in a certain state. So people say that, well, water has more entropy than ice because there's more configurations and molecules that would correspond to water than to ice. So to say that systems tend toward from low entropy to high entropy is simply saying that systems tend to go to states that are more probable. There's more ways they can happen. It's as simple as that. So if you imagine rolling a dice, there are very, very few ways that you'll roll a thousand sixes in a row. I mean, there's only one, in fact. And there's a lot of ways you could roll other numbers. So people have argued that the origin of life can't happen because it's too improbable to have a lot of atoms in a state that corresponds to life. That argument is incomplete because there's also another driving tendency of nature. Yes, nature will typically go from order to disorder or from low entropy to high entropy, but nature also wants to go from high energy to low energy. And those two tendencies at times can work against each other. So the reason that water will freeze and turn to ice in low temperature is because the attractive forces between the water molecules mean that ice is a lower energy state than water is. Now, what happens is when water becomes ice, it releases heat into the environment. So when that heat goes into the environment, the entropy of the environment goes up by a larger amount than the entropy of the water goes down. So to think of it in terms of loaded dice, the probability or the entropy corresponds to how hard it is to roll a certain set of numbers on a dice. But the energy relates to how much the dice are loaded. So in nature, the dice are loaded for low energy. But here's the problem. Life is a state of both low entropy or very high order. It's very improbable. And it's a state of very high energy. So for simple chemicals on the early Earth to become a cell, they both have to go to low entropy, a very, very improbable state, and they have to absorb energy from the environment to increase what's called their free energy. That's a physical impossibility that never, ever happens in the universe, except if it has help, which I'll get into.
Okay. With that, I'm going to turn this over to you to show us some slides, and then we're going to get back with a series of questions.
Okay, certainly. So what happens is if you look at the argument and how it's evolved over the last few decades, the issue that people have thought about is what if we're in a system that's driven by energy? So it's driven outside of equilibrium. And what happens is these systems driven out of equilibrium, you get what's called self-organization. And that's kind of like if you have a tornado, the flow of energy and mass into the system creates a funnel cloud. It self-organizes. If you boil water, you get roll patterns. That's a self-organizational pattern. And people have said maybe that's how life formed. Maybe if you shove energy into a system, that will create a self-organizational process that would create a cell. And that's actually completely false. Because while the order in these systems driven from equilibrium takes place at the macro state, at the large level you see order, at the micro state, at the molecular state, you have more disorder. You're actually generating entropy. And that gets into the work of people like Jeremy England. That gets into what are called the fluctuation theorems. And the last few decades, there's a very sophisticated theorems related to non-equilibrium thermodynamics, like the Evans-Searle fluctuation theorem or Crookes fluctuation theorem. And what they've shown is that it's as improbable for a chemical system to go to both low entropy and high energy away from equilibrium as it is near equilibrium. So that means arguing that any physical process could take a bunch of chemicals and form a cell is the modern day version of a perpetual motion machine. Now, the only way that life does it is it has engines. It has these molecular engines like ATP synthase. And what these engines do is they take energy from the environment. It could be things like glucose, it could be sunlight, it could be some other chemical. And it converts that energy into a form useful for the cell, like ATP. So engines are necessary to provide the energy required for life. Also, cells have information. What cells have are enzymes and other structures, and enzymes are proteins, and they're a chain of amino acids, and there's 20 amino acids that form a protein in the same way you've got 26 letters in the English alphabet that form sentences. So you can think of these protein changes like sentences where the alphabet is 20 amino acids. And if the information in that chain is right, the right sequence, it folds into the right three-dimensional shape, and that enzyme can then drive the right chemical reaction. And that enzyme can also extract energy from these high-energy molecules like ATP and use that energy to drive the reaction in a way that it would not normally would go. So it can actually become a higher free energy product. So it's information and engines that are necessary for life. And I had a wonderful exchange with Jeremy England, and I made that point. And in his response, he either explicitly or implicitly confirmed all of those claims. Now, I want to show, I'm going to go to my slide presentation. And this is a very recent paper. It's 2018. And one of the authors is Michael Russell. And he's one of the architects of like the thermal vent theory of the origin of life. And in this paper, he actually acknowledges all of these points I just made. Because he says for life, you've got to have engines that provide energy in a form that can power cellular processes. So you have to have these engines, and you have to have machinery that selects specific chemical reactions and creates the right small environments to produce target products, and it also blocks other reactions. And again, this gets back to information, because these machines he's referring to, again, are enzymes that have the information in the sequences. And he talks about how in life you have to control the reactions based on cellular and external conditions. So if it's hotter or colder, or if the pH is different, the cell has to sense the external environment, sense its internal environment, and control reactions in that fashion. And there's also another research paper that was by that talks about the challenge of those control systems. So what I'm showing you now is simply an example of a feedback loop in a cell called the lac operon. It's one of the simplest feedback loops. And this is necessary because this particular operon, which is a set of genes, controls the digestion of a sugar called lactose. And what happens is when there's lactose in the environment, there's a feedback that causes the enzymes to be produced to digest the lactose. But if there isn't lactose, then the thing shuts off. So it's this feedback loop. And you have to have these sort of control systems throughout life. And this paper, it talks about the difficulty of that. And what it says, noteworthy, the probability of instability of a randomly selected state increases rapidly with increasing size of the system. Its stability and thus its existence over a prolonged period of time depends crucially on the numerical values of kinetic parameters and regulatory interactions. In other words, if you imagine the origin of life, and just through some miracle, a cell almost forms, it has all of the proteins, the DNA, the cell membrane, but the feedback loops are not quite right. They're either too strong or too weak, or the metabolites, the chemical products aren't in the right proportions, the metabolism shuts down and it quickly will destabilize and decompose into simple chemicals. So this is really, really challenging. So what happens is you have other researchers like Yasser Demiral who talk about the same issue. And here's a great point. It says the ATP synthesis in turn is matched and synchronized to cellular ATP utilization processes. Since energy and matter flows must be directed by the information for them to be functional and serve a purpose. For living systems, the information is the cause and the entropy reduction is the result. Energy plus matter plus information is a locally reduced entropy. So what all these authors are saying is for a cell to function, you again have to have energy provided and you have to have machinery that directs that energy in such a way that allows a cell to function. And you have to have highly specialized control systems to control these chemical processes, or else the whole system destabilizes, and that all goes back to more information in DNA. So this is what this author and other authors are saying. Now, here's the really key point. How does he deal with this? And this is the second part of that same article. It's part two, and here's a quote from it, and what he says is, he says, we claim in particular that it is untenable to hold that life-relevant biochemistry could have emerged in the chemical chaos produced by mass action chemistry and chemically non-specifically energy inputs, and only later have evolved its dauntingly specific mechanisms as a part of evolving the rest of life's features. So what this author is saying, who is really very respected in the origin of life community, is that it is a physical impossibility for chemicals on the early Earth and random energy inputs to produce a cell. Now that's shocking, but it's interesting to look at how he responds to this challenge. And this is really how all origin of life people deal with this problem. Instead, we claim it had to have been launched simple and specific, and thereafter have been forced by the scythe of natural selection to maintain the necessary specificity standard at each evolutionary increment in complexity. More specifically, all the devices of life, metabolic and structural, must have been invented by it, that's natural selection in situ, step by step, and while in flight, starting from the simplest possible inputs. And learning itself by trial and error which small changes themselves occurring by chance were useful. Each incremental step in the evolution by creeps, complexity building process necessarily being vetted by the system both for fitting in and contributing more utility than cost. Now, I think that's really striking, because what you're seeing in this case is you've had a situation where origin of life experts freely acknowledge that a cell is too improbable to come together by chance. They acknowledge that in order to have this incredible chemistry, you've got to have machinery that directs the chemistry. They acknowledge that you've got to have control systems. And they acknowledge that there's no physical process that can deal with this. So what they do is they appeal to natural selection. The problem is you can't have natural selection if nothing is replicating, if nothing is reproducing. It doesn't make any sense. He's talking about this sort of chemical soup in a thermal vent, and there's nothing replicating, so natural selection isn't real. So origin of life people appeal to natural selection not as a real process, but kind of as a demigod, almost like Plato's demiurge, where it has the intelligence to create a cell. It has the intelligence to select the right chemicals. So they're invoking intelligent design without acknowledging it through the guise of natural selection. And I'll just conclude the section by mentioning they do at times appeal to self-replicating molecules like self-replicating RNA. And the idea again is you've got RNA that's replicating, it's reproducing itself, it goes through small changes, small mutations, and the natural selection selects what's called an abzyme, which is simply an RNA molecule that acts like an enzyme. But here's the problem. If you look at all research on self-replicating molecules, like Spiegelman's monster is a classic example, what you find is replication of molecules only happens if you've got the molecular machinery borrowed from cells to make it happen. If you were to take a bunch of RNA, pour it into a thermal vent or into a small pool, the RNA breaks apart. It won't replicate without help. But even if it did, here's the real problem. What happens when you have self-replicating molecules, RNA or anything else? they become, the ones that dominate are the ones that are more efficient at replication. And they typically become smaller and smaller and more streamlined until all they do is self-replicate and nothing else. So again, all of this appeal to natural selection makes absolutely no sense. So let me stop there and we can go back to the conversation.
Well, this is interesting. You know, we had a project a number of years ago. It was funded by the National Science Foundation to build self-replicating molecules. But we could not use nature's constructs. So we said, how hard would it be to have a parent system, have monomers come up and interact with those, and then hook those monomers together. So now we've got a duplex and then split that apart and have two new mother complexes that could do this. And not using nature's constructs, but having to think of it using our own minds. And what killed us was the fidelity. So our yield might be 70%. So you've got 30% of other things in there. And now you try to do another replication cycle, your yield from the parent is 70%, and that 30% is making other mismatches. And so within a couple of cycles, it was just an utter mess, And what people will do, they'll appeal to selection to purify that mess. But as chemists, you don't have selection. Selection is something that comes with biology, but this is pre-biology. There are no selectors. It's up to the chemist to figure out how to pull those things apart. And it's very difficult because when you're missing one unit from a polymer, it's very hard to distinguish those and pull them apart. So it was just an utter mess. And after 3 years, we never continued with the project because I thought, this is crazy hard.
Yeah, and you've hit on such an incredible insight is that if you look at all plausible prebiotic situations, what happens, and you could go to the Stanley Miller experiment, you could do whatever, is you always have this intractable mixture of different compounds. And it's very unlikely that only the right ones are going to link together. And you know this so much better than I do. But even if you had the help of enzymes, like a polymerase, what you run into is Eigen's paradox, that if you have, let's say, a self-replicating RNA or whatever, and if on average you have a lot more than one change every generation, you're going to lose all your information. You're dead in the water. So that's the big problem, because the way cells deal with this problem is they've got error-correcting mechanisms. Now, the problem is, in any origin of life scenario, is before the cell has enough information to provide those error-correcting mechanisms, it needs those error-correcting mechanisms. So Eigen's paradox kills self-replication long before a cell is large enough to have the error-correcting mechanisms to correct the errors to a level of high fidelity. So you hit the nail on the head.
That was part one of a conversation on the origin of life with James Tuer and Brian Miller, borrowed with permission from Tuer's own show, the Science and Faith podcast. Stay tuned here at ID the Future for parts 2 and 3. I'm Tom Gilson. Thanks for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.